Okay, let's get going. Welcome, everybody. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment Law and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We are based in the southeast of England. We work with employers that are all over the world that have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we help them. I was about to say, delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague Adrienne. However, you may have noticed that it is just me today. We've permitted Adrienne the luxury of taking a holiday. So she has gone off traveling and I'm flying solo today. So you're stuck with me for the next half an hour or so. So I hope that's okay. For those of you that are not familiar with these sessions, we do record them. You can get all the video footage on our website, which is MPM Legal. And you can also listen to the audio on our podcast, which is on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple, wherever else you like to listen to your podcasts. I think we're on episode 73 now. So you really will find something of interest, hopefully, on those platforms. Just search up Employment Law 101. As I'm flying solo, if you've got questions today, it'll just really help me manage them if you can use the Q&A function down at the bottom toolbar if you've got specific questions, and I'll try and do my best to answer them as I go along. If you want to chat to the other participants, just use a chat function that's down at the bottom as well. Thank you. Today we are talking about the commercial realities of 2P. 2P tends to be one of those divisive topics. You fall into the category of either loving it or hating it. I did used to loathe 2P when I first started out practicing law, employment law, 20 years ago. Now I quite like it. It's quite formulaic and quite regimented, and I don't know, there's some comfort in that. So I'm a 2P convert. Back in the day, I used to do quite a lot of sessions with the CIPD, and on those feedback forms you get at the end of sessions, always there were people asking for 2P related content. I don't know why, but it was something that people had a bit of a fascination with, and I think just wanted to understand more about. So what I'm going to be going through today are essentially my nine top tips in terms of the commercial realities of 2P. Now, for those of you that don't know, 2P stands for the Transfer of Undertakings Protection of Employment Regulations. Now, it does feel like a really legalistic topic, but in practice, it's as much about people planning and risk management as it is about those legal principles. What I want you to get from the session today are just those commercial tips that you, as HR professionals, people leaders, those of you that are in-house counsel, can just take away and help to inform those 2P transfers you might have on the horizon, and hopefully help them all to run smoothly, mitigate legal risk, have everything ticking along. So think of this session as a little bit of a toolkit, really. Okay. As I say, I'll try and deal with questions as we go along, but I might leave some to the end. So let's start at the beginning. First of all, tip number one, identify what the type of transfer is and do that early. So those of you that are new to 2P, it can apply in a couple of main ways. The first is a business transfer. So you'll get that on a sale and purchase exercise. So a business is being acquired by another company, and it intends to fold in that business within its existing portfolio on purchase. Okay. Now, I just want to point out that share sales and purchases alone typically don't trigger 2P. Now, there have been some cases where, and we love a bit of case law on this, but there have been cases where a share sale has been found to trigger 2P because of the specific circumstances around the share purchase. But normally, if you're just purchasing the shares in another company, but that other company retains its legal identity, it's still trading as a standalone legal entity, it's just the owners of the shares behind the scenes are now different. Normally, that's insufficient to trigger 2P. So, the general rule of thumb is it doesn't apply to share purchases. It does apply to business transfers, number one. The second area that it applies to, and this might be the area that most of you have encountered 2P, is in terms of what we call service provision changes. So, there we're talking about things like first generation outsourcing. So, an example of that is I have a factory, I've got a canteen in my factory. I employ people to work in that canteen. I no longer want the cost and expense and hassle of doing that, so I'm going to outsource it to a third-party company who are going to come in and run the canteen provision for me at my site. That's going to be a first-generation outsourcing. There's scope in that situation for my employees who are working in the canteen to be transferred over to the incoming provider. Okay. Retendering as well. So sticking with my example, I decide after 2 years of running the contract with this third-party company that actually I don't like them very much. The service isn't great. I'm going to go with a different provider. So I'm going to outsource it again, but to a new provider, second generation outsourcing or retendering. There's scope there for those employees of the first contractor company to 2P and bounce over to the new incoming provider. So 2P can bite in that situation. Third example in terms of service provision changes. So I've gone with a second provider for another 2 years. I'm still dissatisfied with the service provision. And I think, actually, do you know what? I think it was better after all when I was running my own canteen services and I employed people directly to do that. I'm going to in-house it. So on expiry of the contract, it's going to bring it back in-house and I'm going to run the canteen provision. That can also trigger 2P. It's another example of a service provision change. Now, you might have spotted the kind of obvious flaw and weakness and criticism that we see around 2P transfers of that nature, which is if the dissatisfaction with the service is often with the people delivering the service, if those individuals are bouncing from one company to another, and ultimately, in my example, ending up back with me, I might still be getting poor service, but then I suppose it's on me to manage that proactively. But that is a weakness in respect of how the rules apply. But ultimately, it's about preserving the employment and the employment rights of those individuals that are engaged in providing the service. Now, getting it wrong at an early stage can obviously derail a deal. So, for example, if you're a business that's tendering for work and you're assuming that 2P doesn't apply and there are no employee liabilities and costs to take account of, obviously that's going to have a massive impact in terms of potential future liability and cost of service, and even whether it's commercially viable for you. So, that's why it's important to identify, is 2P engaged? And if so, what type of 2P are we talking about? And what are the rules that then flow from that? I think a practical pointer around this first tip then is just mapping out the deal structure at a heads of term stage and effectively running a 2P test. So don't wait until the contract drafting stage if you're involved on those sides of the transaction. Start stress testing how 2P could apply, and then you're not going to have any surprises. Okay, second tip. And this is mapping the workforce thoroughly. So, if we think about 2P, what we're interested in are employees who are assigned to the relevant part of the business. And that word assigned is quite key and appears in the relevant rules. Those employees who are assigned to the bit of the business that's transferring will automatically transfer. So, think of it as them following the work over. Now, that doesn't just mean what's an employee's job title. It's about where they spend their working time and whether they're part of an organized grouping of employees as well. Now, as you can imagine, there is a heck of a lot of case law that looks at these principles and specifically this point around what counts as an employee being assigned. And it's something that we get asked a lot about as well, which is, well, how much time does somebody need to spend working on a particular contract for them to be caught by the automatic transfer provision? There isn't a very easy way to answer that because essentially it's a fact-based question or a factual question, and it takes into account a number of different factors. So I think if you come to us and ask that question, we'll probably be asking you a bunch of questions in return just to get that information to help you make a decision. But ultimately, you're going to have to make a judgment call on it. As I say, that's going to be based on a number of different factors forming that decision. Where we see complications are things like employees who have got split roles. So they might be spending a certain amount of their working time on one particular contract that you could lose, and another part of their working day or working time is spent on an entirely unrelated matter, maybe an in-house matter or something that is still being retained. So what do you do in that situation? What about temporary staff, people who are seconded, and also agency workers who aren't actually covered but can impact your resourcing as well? So someone's asking about contracts. So I mentioned contracts because, in my example, the factory that I run, where I've got my catering set up, I'll be contracting out that catering provision. So I'll have a contract with a third-party provider to come in and do the catering. Now, it doesn't necessarily follow that an employee of that third-party company who comes to work on my site to run my catering provision spends all of their working time at my site. They may spend Monday and Tuesday at my site. They may spend 3 days of the week at that third-party company's other contract that they hold with a different factory running their own catering provision. So that's why it's very factual and context specific in terms of determining whether an employee is assigned to the part of the business that's going to transfer. So really, the takeaway point here is doing some kind of functional analysis of who's actually working on the transferring service. Now, quite often that is going to be straightforward to determine. You're going to have your list of employees. You're going to know who's working on the thing that's going to be transferring out or coming in if you're on the other side. But sometimes we do encounter what we call woodwork employees, and they're the employees who come out of the woodwork during 2P. They stick their hands up and say, "Oh, everyone seems to have forgotten about me. I am actually assigned to this bit, and I believe my employment should have transferred under 2P." Now, you want to try and avoid any surprises like that. Employment lawyers generally don't like surprises like that in transactions. So, again, as part of your due diligence phase at the start of a particular project where you're considering 2P being engaged, do as much analysis as you can to figure out who is actually working on the transferring service. Okay. A similar point in relation to tip three, and what I've got is auditing terms and conditions of employment beforehand. Now, one of the central rules about 2P transfers is changes to employees' terms and conditions of employment are void if the sole or principal reason for changing them is the transfer itself. So, just having a situation of we're transferring some employees, we want to use this opportunity to change their terms and conditions of employment, it's not going to get you very far. They're all going to be voidable in the future, which brings a lot of uncertainty as to whether or not you can actually rely on them. And the problem with that is you're probably not going to find out until some point in the future where you enter a bit of a legal bun fight over whether changes you made on a 2P transfer a few years previously will actually hold water. So you want to avoid that situation. Now, there is a small exception to when you are permitted to change terms and conditions of employment, and that is if you need to do so for a what's called an ETO, an economic, technical, or organizational reason. I'm not going to go sort of too far down the rabbit hole in terms of ETO reasons, but just to be aware as a concept, generally, changes to terms and conditions of employment for transferring employees, not great. The general principle is you shouldn't do it. However, if you can shoehorn it into an ETO reason, or you legitimately have an ETO reason, I should say, then you are permitted to make those changes. Where does this bring us to in this third tip? Ultimately, all terms and conditions will transfer, not just the ones that you like the best. So, things like enhanced redundancy rights, very long notice periods, benefits which you might think are quite costly and expensive to maintain, certain bonus schemes, even unusual holiday entitlements, they may all transfer across. And sometimes buyers can underestimate the cost impact of transferring those things over, things like enhanced sick pay, for example. So, auditing terms and conditions of employment, and doing that at an early stage, so a due diligence stage on a transaction, it's going to link back to your commercial position. So you want to be in a position where you've bottomed out so far as you can what the cost is going to be of you inheriting employees if you're on that side of the deal. And then factoring that into the commercial terms because it comes at a cost. It's going to impact in terms of your profitability and the cost of you actually providing the services. So that's the third tip. Tip number four It's all about planning your consultation strategy early. Now, the reason I mention consultation is that 2P requires you to inform and, if appropriate, consult with employee representatives or trade unions, if you're a business that recognizes a trade union, in terms of the 2P transfer. Now, helpfully, the law did change last year. So if you're a business that has fewer than 50 employees, you don't have to have employee representatives nominated and elected. Now, this is just, I want to make clear, in respect of 2P transfers. It's not in respect of collective redundancy consultations, where you may have also encountered this concept of collective representation through employee reps. So fewer than 50 employees, no reps. Or if you're a business of any size, but you have fewer than 10 transferring employees, then equally you don't need reps. So you can tick the box in terms of your information and consultation requirements concerning 2P directly with employees, which is obviously really, really helpful in terms of the practicalities of that sort of exercise. Now, the obligations are on both sides of a 2P transaction, so the transferor and the transferee, so the organization that's potentially losing employees where they're transferring out, and the transferee, so the incoming organization who are potentially gaining employees as well. There are prescribed rules in terms of information that needs to be provided, and then consultation in respect of any proposed measures. Now, normally, one side of the deal will only be providing information. There won't actually be a requirement to consult because of the nature of the transaction. But that's not always the case. So again, very, very factual and context specific, and take advice in terms of what you need to do. The big watch out is, as with collective redundancy consultation, if there's a failure to consult, it can result in protective awards. And those protective awards are unusual in terms of employment tribunal compensation because they are designed to be punitive and to punish the employer for not complying. The penalty is up to 13 weeks gross pay per affected employee. And it's an uncapped liability as well. So again, those of you who are familiar with things like statutory redundancy payments, which apply a capped weekly amount of pay, the cap is removed for the purposes of these transfers. So you're looking at gross pay, it's uncapped. It can quickly add up to quite a large sum of money, such that if it's a fairly small commercial contract, the value of the penalty could outweigh the value of the deal. And obviously, you don't want to be in that situation. So, all the more reason to get your information and consultation obligations absolutely met. Really, I think the takeaway there is build that consultation timeline into the project planning phase, particularly if you do actually need elections for employee representatives. So you've got to account a couple of weeks for that, really, a couple of working weeks, to explain to employees what's happening, give them the opportunity to nominate and elect reps to actually hold that election. And then you might also want to consider, it's not mandatory, but it's something we do a lot of and we always recommend, training those employee reps so they understand what the legal framework is that they're working in, so they can really better fulfill their role and their duties as employee reps, with the aim that everything then flows nicely and ticks along nicely. So that was tip four: plan your consultation strategy early. Tip five, I'm going to talk about things called warranties and indemnities. And this might appeal to those of you who work more on the legal side and are involved in the commercial contracts. Essentially, warranties and indemnities are legal promises and provisions in commercial contracts that talk about apportionment of liability. And one party will rely on warranties as being a legal promise from the other party that certain things are true and factually accurate. Now, the general principle is that the incoming employer, so if you're inheriting employees, you inherit all rights, obligations, and liabilities. And so that's why it's really, really important that the contractual protections, which are in the form of these warranties and indemnities, are absolutely right. Outgoing, if you're on the outgoing side of the transaction, and this is where negotiation becomes relevant because you might have an imbalance of power. But outgoing employers will typically look to limit their liability. So they will want to try and generally escape with giving as little to the incoming employer as possible. I mean, particularly in a situation where a contract's been lost to a competitor, for example, in an outsourcing exercise. The incoming employer is obviously going to want as much protection as possible. So they're going to want, promises around things like the accuracy of staff lists, because like we've talked about, they want to avoid a scenario where there's woodwork employees appearing and saying, "Hi, you've forgotten about me. I'm now your employee," and it's not been factored in. Correct pay data, because obviously, you need to make sure that your costings, the cost of employing these people, is all mapped out correctly as well. And then indemnities as well. So, just making sure that they're protected if there are any pre-transfer claims. So the incoming employer doesn't want to be facing employment tribunal litigation in respect of acts or omissions done by the outgoing employer, but because liability is transferred over with the contract, the scope for the incoming employer to be in the firing line for that. So ultimately, what we're talking about here in terms of this fifth tip of getting your warranties and indemnities right is making sure that your legal and commercial teams are talking to each other and that they're speaking the same language. Okay. Don't just leave it up to the lawyers. The lawyers will need a good commercial understanding and grounding in terms of what the context is for the deal. Because obviously, speaking as a lawyer, that helps us to map out the risk and think about the things that we need to drop into the commercial contracts that deal specifically with the people provisions. Okay. If there are weak indemnities in there, yes, it might be because that's all you've been able to commercially negotiate, but you do have exposure. You do have potential legal exposure in respect of claims if those warranties and indemnities are not tightly drafted. So don't neglect that part. That's a really, really critical component to any deals that you might be doing. Okay. Coming on to tip number six, before I get to that, for those of you that joined a little bit later, just want to mention again, you can get the recordings from our past session on the MPM Legal website and listen to Employment Law 101 on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music as well. So please delve into those back issues. We did a session on the Employment Rights Bill last week, on the last session, sorry, 2 weeks ago. And towards the end of June, we had a session on that. So there's a lot of interest around Employment Rights Bill changes at the moment, so be sure to catch those episodes. Back to 2P transfers though. Tip number six, handle harmonization with care. So we see this a lot, an instinct after there's a 2P transfer to try and standardize terms. That comes up, we want to harmonize, we want to standardize. Remember what I said before about harmonization of contractual terms. 2P makes that very difficult. You need to have that economic, technical, or organizational reason involving changes in the workforce to make valid changes. If you try and make changes otherwise, you're running the risk that the changes you've made are actually void, and that means it's going to be difficult or impossible to enforce at a point in the future. So bear that in mind. Harmonization just for convenience, you want to align holiday entitlement, or you just like your contracts to look the same and you're starting to change people's actual terms and conditions of employment to match that, is likely going to be unlawful and not permitted. So think very carefully about what the underpinning reason is for harmonization and actually whether it fits into that category of being an ETO reason for doing so. I think the practical takeaway point there really is set realistic expectations with management. So, you're not going to be able to strip out certain cost overnight. There's going to be a period of change, and sometimes it is actually cheaper to grandfather terms for a period of time and then just deal with the change through natural attrition or when there's some other obvious change point that isn't related to the 2p transfer. Because for so long as people can peg things back to the fact of the 2p transfer, the protections under 2p are going to apply. There's no kind of rule that says once you get 1 year out from a 2p transfer, you're in the clear to make certain changes. Obviously, with the passage of time, the longer that time goes on and the further you are away from a 2p transfer, the harder it is to make that link. But if that link can be made, time doesn't really matter. Let me just dip in because someone's asked a question about keeping of terms and conditions of employment regarding pension rights of employees transferring from one organisation to another. Okay, on pension rights, I'm not going to go into it just in the interests of time, but there are specific rules about certain types of pensions, and particularly occupational pensions as well. I think the point to be aware of there is the existence of different rules which impact on pension provision. So look for those or come and speak to me and I can help you with those. Good morning, Elaine. You can change T's and C's until they get promotion, though, can't you? Asks Elaine. So I think you're asking, can you change terms and conditions of employment on promotion? Well, yes, if the reason for the terms and conditions change is you're promoted into this other role, and then what comes with this role is this particular package, and we need you to work this particular pattern, and you get this particular pay arrangement. Maybe you get a different bonus arrangement. Maybe you work in a different location because of the promotion, and that's what the role requires. That's all fine. None of that's related to the 2p transfer. What we're kind of most interested in is changes for the sake of changes, because they're directly related to the fact of the 2p transfer, and that's where you run more of a risk. Okay, tip seven, look out for information gaps. So the law does require the transferor, so the outgoing employer, to provide something called employee liability information. It's what we call ELI, at least 28 days before the transfer. Now, again, there are penalties if that information is not provided. The transferee, so the new employer, can go to an employment tribunal and seek up to £500 per employee for whom the information is not provided. So there is a real world liability there, though I personally have never seen a claim or been involved in a claim in relation to that. What we do actually see is data that's often late, it's incomplete, or it's contested. Now, that makes integration for you a lot harder because you don't know what you're dealing with. And remember, a lot of this is about costing, financial forecasting. What is the cost of this deal? This again is where your commercial terms really come into play. And what you have to have regard of as well is if you're a provider of services to a third party and you're losing the contract and things are being transferred away to another third party provider, do go back and look at the contract that you signed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years previously. Because if it's well drafted, there'll be a load of provisions in there that deal with exit. And so, irrespective of what 2P says about the provision of employee liability information, not only will you have to comply with that as a legal minimum standard, but you may be contractually bound to provide certain information at a certain point in time, not only to the party that you're providing services to, but potentially to the prospective incoming employer as well. So don't neglect commercial terms that you may have previously signed. Equally, if you're the, in my example, the factory, and you're doing your contracting and you've finished with that contractor and you're bringing in a new catering company, so a new contractor, I would really want to tie down on my side of the contract what I'm expecting to see by way of information flow between those two parties. Not only because I might be doing that second generation outsourcing, but because also I might be in-housing the service at some point. So I might need one of those third party companies to be really prescriptive in terms of the information that it's giving me. So think about that data as well. Tip eight of nine, manage communication with sensitivity. Now, again, we know from doing these larger scale 2P transfers, the concept of 2P itself often signals uncertainty. I mean, a lot like collective redundancy processes and other collective change processes. Will I lose my job? Will my pay change. You know, do I even want to work for this new employer, which I've encountered before? You know, it goes without saying, but poor communication, weak communication, it can cause resignations. If you're a unionized worker, industrial unrest, reputational damage as well, if it's all mishandled. So really, the takeaway point here is do coordinate HR, legal, and your internal comm strategy as well. One thing that's really good I like to use in collective change processes is just a rolling frequently asked questions document. You can stick it online, your employees can access it, they can see what other employees are raising, they can see what the company's line is in response. It avoids a lot of duplication of information, and it's very, very transparent. Obviously, you need to make sure that messaging is clear, that it's supportive, and that it's factually correct, of course, but it's a really, really good way of just managing the information flow. Final tip on 2P, tip number 9, don't forget about the post-transfer integration. So the legal transfer itself is really just the starting point, okay? And I know a lot of you that are on the HR side will be very, very alive to this and the fact that you're thinking about things like cultural integration between companies, new reporting lines, new IT systems, you know, some of the practical aspects, payroll, that we all know and love, and getting that organized as well. They all really, really are key components of 2P transfers. And, you know, sometimes where we see issues, it's after the actual fact of the transfer itself. So it's employees who maybe don't feel as valued in their new setup, or where there's missed payroll issues, for example, or people, you know, managers not being aware of entitlements that certain employees have. All of that has the scope to erode trust. So it's a kind of risk point, really. So I think the takeaway with this one in terms of post-transfer integration is really think about your post-transfer onboarding plan. So what sort of welcome meetings are you going to have? What sort of check-ins? How visible is your leadership? All of that is going to prevent disputes from arising, and it's really going to contribute to the goodwill as well. Okay, I think I'm 2 minutes over time, which for us, if you're a regular listener, isn't too bad. I'll take that. But that brings us to the last of our 9 2P tips. So just to recap on those, we've looked at really the importance of identifying the type of transfer early, scoping out the right employees. So just being very, very clear in terms of who's actually caught, managing those terms and conditions and liabilities. So really thinking about your commercial terms as well, more than anything. Looking at consultation, communication, and post-transfer integration, which is something that's absolutely not to be neglected. And then ultimately protecting yourself through smart contracts, and due diligence is a big part of that also. So, you know, keep your lawyers and your legal teams close by if you're on the commercial side. Ultimately, we know 2P isn't just legal compliance as an exercise. It's a commercial challenge and it's a people challenge, all melted together. And that's probably why I like it, actually, thinking about it. Where we see success with it is that early stage planning. So getting the planning in early, really, really effective communication with it, and just building the protections in terms of the commercial deal. So it does involve a lot of people with their various expertise coming together to make that happen. Okay, I think I've answered the questions that we've had today. So as ever, thank you so much for joining us. If you're listening to this in the future on Spotify, I just want to ask a quick favor, which is please do give us a rating if you're enjoying listening to our podcast. That just helps with our visibility. Likewise, if you enjoy these sessions, please do spread the word. The more the merrier that can join us is absolutely fantastic. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'll hopefully be back with my colleague Adrienne as well, and we will see you then. But in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week, and goodbye, everybody.